Hey everyone, quick favor to ask before we get to the show. Could you please, if you got time, go to podcastlistener.com/LEFT and answer a few short questions. It would be super helpful to all three of us. Again, that's podcastlistener.com/LEFT. Answer a short survey if you got time. Thank you so much, everyone. Here's the show.
There's no place to escape to.
This is the last
podcast
on the left.
That's when the cannibalism started.
What was that?
Let's see. So should we start the show?
Let's start the show.
All right. Welcome to the last podcast on the left, everyone. I am Ben Kitzel. That's Marcus Barks.
Hello.
And we've got H-Bone, Henry Zabrowski in Atlanta.
Oklahoma, where the wind comes and up plains. It's not going to be as fun as the musical.
No, it definitely
will
not. No, today we're going to be talking about Oklahoma City. Of course, the bombing that occurred in 1995. Extremely heavy topic. But once again, Marcus and H-Bone, I think there's some crack research in here and a lot of information that's going to be enlightening to our audience.
So on April 19th, 1995, a conspiracy-minded Gulf War vet named Timothy McVeigh parked a 7,000-pound ammonium nitrate fuel bomb loaded on a yellow Ryder moving truck in front of the Alfred P. Mura Federal Building in downtown Oklahoma City. Mm. When all was said and done after the bomb was detonated, 168 people were dead and over 800 were injured.
Oh. And honestly, that's his biggest crime. His second biggest crime is owning that neon yellow Mercury.
Oh my
God. Not drove around it, which is disgusting.
It's a pastel yellow. All right.
We'll get into some of his interesting car choices, to say the least. Although I will say in this episode, no yacht, which that's kind of a big deal.
And yeah, it's Oklahoma. It's landlocked.
Okay.
Now, according to McVeigh, this act of domestic terror was done in part as retaliation for the siege at the Mount Carmel compound in Waco, Texas, the climax of which came 2 years to the day before the Oklahoma City bombing. For those of you who don't know, the Waco siege involved a cult named the Branch Davidians. The Davidians were stockpiling various weapons. The ATF got wind. They decided to raid the place and fucked up the entire operation spectacular.
Now, I will say I do not support what the government, federal government did regarding Waco, or we'll get into Ruby Ridge, but Janet Reno was played perfectly by Will Ferrell on Saturday Night Live. And so that is a bright side. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And the Branch Davidians were not good.
No.
They did not do good things.
No.
But the ATF fucked up everything, and we're going to see that they're going to fuck up a lot more as the time goes. And I don't know why. Because it seems like a very sensitive place. It seems like everyone should be really good at their jobs at the ATF. But it seems like they really mess it up. They bungle. There's a bunch of bumble butts.
Yeah, that's true.
About the end of the 51-day Waco siege, 76 Branch Davidians, including 25 children, had died in a fire set under the direction of cult leader David Koresh as government agencies stormed the compound in a last-ditch effort to flush out the cult members. Now, there was a lot of bad shit happening in that compound, not the least of which was David Koresh's multiple child brides.
Which would have been totally cool if he had made Annie Hall first.
This is technically a Woody Allen joke, so we're going to let that pass.
Thank you.
But, of course, this is where a lot of the conspiracy theories come in as well when it comes to the fire. There's a lot of different videos and stuff. And they're like, you can see them spraying in napalm and those sorts of things. Which is not what they did.
That wasn't what it was. It was tear gas. David Koresh set the fires to kill everyone.
There was an audio recording of them saying, like, David said to pour the fuel, right? Like, yeah, David said to pour the fuel. Man, I wish we had more hay.
Yep, I can't wait.
Yeah. And we'll also get a lot more into those videos that show the flame supposedly coming out of the tanks in Waco. That's going to play a huge part in this story. Videos and rumors like that.
These conspiracy theories have real life ramifications, and that's what we're talking about here.
They absolutely do, because that's the thing, is that the radical right didn't see it that way. They didn't see it as David Koresh had all these child brides that needed to be free. In their minds, and specifically in the mind of Timothy McVeigh, Waco was proof that all the conspiracy theories that have been swirling around gun shows and in pamphlets for years were finally coming true. Now, remember,
honestly, if gun shows weren't so bad, it does sound like a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if they were literally like Beverly Hills Cop 3, where you just had a really quirky European dude selling you huge weapons, that's fun. And you have a crime that you have to solve and stuff. But usually it's just people who want to get an arsenal of guns to protect their families from cows.
Yeah. Now, remember, all this is pre-internet. If you wanted to get a hold of wacky shit, you had to go out of your way and look for it.
The good old days.
Yeah.
You had to really work to be a conspiracy theorist back then.
like,
do you remember the dude that we used to go to in Union Square, the big fat guy that would wear sunglasses at night?
Oh,
and you'd
yeah.
have to go through his piles of stuff to find the really fucked up esoteric documentaries about how, like, Martin Luther King was half Jewish and he was a cyborg legs.
Yeah, that was back in the day. It's a similar thing when weed is legalized. You no longer have to hang out with the weird guy who just wants to chill for 90 minutes and you try to get him out of your apartment as quick as possible.
Yeah, see, conspiracies about the New World Order coming to take away your guns and subjugate the American people, that shit wasn't in your pocket.
Right.
You had to go searching on the fringes for that type of thought. And Waco wasn't even the beginning for these people mm-hmm. as far as the far-reaching New World Order conspiracies went. Less than a year earlier, the ATF had participated in another huge fuck-up in a siege at Ruby Ridge mm-hmm. in northern Idaho.
I would go as far to say is that Ruby Ridge was a genuinely gigantic fuck up.
Oh, absolutely.
Even more so than Waco. Ruby Ridge was like, they performed almost on a criminal level. The fact that, like, we'll go through it right now.
We'll get into it, yeah.
See, Ruby Ridge was a standoff between the U.S. government and a white supremacist named Randy Weaver, who was holed up in the cabin with his wife, two kids, and a friend of theirs. Long story short, by the end of it, Randy's wife and son were dead, an ATF agent was dead, and Randy and his friend were wounded. Well, what the story was with Ruby Ridge is this guy, Randy Weaver, had pretty much been entrapped into sawing off some barrels off of shotguns, and he had a warrant.
By the U.S. government.
By the U.S. government.
They
set
him up. And then this is very standard FBI, ATF procedure. You just get one, you tell them they're in a very difficult predicament, and you flip them to get all of the leaders. Randy Weaver was not a leader in the white supremacist movement. That's why they were using him to get to the to the big fish. He refused to go along with the ATF and what the federal government wanted to do. So they just hold up in their home, and it just escalated, and every mistake that could be made was made. Mm-hmm. And then you have the situation where the death of his son, the death of his wife, the ATF, the FBI did not realize they shot his wife, and they consistently used him. They would tell him to just let your wife free, and then we can negotiate. And he thought that they were taunting him.
Yeah, he sat in that house with his dead wife for a week before
can
they
you
finally
imagine
came
that?
Out.
Yeah.
So McVeigh, he used these two incidents to justify his actions.
Yeah.
Here's McVeigh saying that himself.
Who started the war? Who was the aggressor? That's how I look at the Murrah bombing. To me, it wasn't the start of a war, it was a counterattack. The war had already been started. You guys think you can be ruthless? Let's see how you like it when the fight is brought to you.
And go fuck yourself.
Oh my God.
That's what I say. I say go fuck yourself.
That would be the appropriate response. But this really, Ruby Ridge was really amplified as well by this character, Bo Gritz, mm-hmm. Who was a big leader in the white supremacist movement, also at the time running for president. So he took this as a diplomatic opportunity to show what a great diplomatic leader he would be. And he attempted to broker the deal between the family and the FBI.
And he did. But if you watch the document, there's a documentary, a great American Experience documentary about Ruby Ridge.
Yeah,
and
awesome.
They interview Bo Gritz, and man, he is so happy to have been a part of something.
I gotta say, it's an opportunity. It just nice to be a part of it. You know, it's like when I was first. Now that I'm on the set of Crash and HBO's Crashing, it's a wonderful opportunity.
Now, the official story is that Timothy McVeigh was a lone wolf helped by a man named Terry Nichols, who said that he went along with it only because McVeigh had threatened both Nichols' life and the life of his family. Mm. But to me, that doesn't make any sense.
Right.
If you look at the history of mass murder in America, lone wolves are sick people.
Mm-hmm.
They're guys like Charles Whitman at UT, who had a brain tumor, or Sung Cho at Virginia Tech, who had more mental problems than we have time to go into here.
And a very strange YouTube account. My goodness.
Yeah, I mean, Timothy McVeigh is not writing Richard McBeef.
He should have, though. Right. Honestly, though, if he could have just managed to channel his anger into song, the songs would have been horrible.
Yes,
but at least
been.
They would have been songs.
Now, Timothy McVeigh was not sick. Sure, he no doubt suffered from PTSD from his time in the Gulf War, which we will get into, but McVeigh was not sick the way Sung Cho was sick. Mm. McVeigh was radicalized.
Hmm. Absolutely. He was a part of a gigantic network. I think he was completely supported. I'm with you, Dog Meat, on that whole front. He was given a copy of a book called The Turner Diaries that we're going to go into more deeper detail next episode. But that book is going to be sort of like the invitation to the Aryan Nation that is going to move people. This is American ISIS. Essentially, people like Louis Beam, who came out and said this idea of leaderless revolution, of little pods of people doing gigantic, horrible, violent acts that he hoped would just happen without a central network, which is terrorism. Domestic terrorism.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Timothy McVeigh is the definition of domestic terrorism.
He's the poster child of domestic terrorism.
He is the Garth Brooks of domestic terrorism.
Don't bring Garth Brooks into this. Every time you bring up Garth Brooks, I'm forced to get defensive because the thunder does roll. And we have to remember that the thunder rolls. It's not just a weather report, it's also a great song.
You know who was the face of domestic terrorism before this, which is sad that he got bumped? The kid from Problem Child.
If you really take those movies like a serious crime drama, he was horrible.
Dennis the Menace.
Yep.
American terrorist.
Now, in this series, we aim to show just how Timothy McVeigh got to this point, how he was inspired by a white separatist, quote-unquote, patriot movement that still thrives and is defended to this day, and how irrational conspiracy beliefs justified McVeigh's actions to himself. Mm-hmm. We also plan to show how it is very possible, if not probable, that there were many more people involved than just McVeigh and Nichols, and how the entire thing, just like 9/11, 6 years later, could have been prevented if not for the incompetence and short-sightedness of a few law enforcement officials who weren't listening to what their people were telling them.
And they were actively fighting one another. They were in competition with one another, not fighting for the greater good of the American people, which is what they should be doing.
Yes.
I think the term short-sightedness is the most important thing. Like, yes, they did fuck some things up, but mostly it was about they just wanted to have the crime be closed. They wanted the case closed. They wanted Timothy McVeigh in jail, and that's it. Because the complicated weaving of getting into how do you shut down Elohim City? How do you shut down, like, the CSA? All these gigantic networks, these white supremacy networks that were sort of hidden. The white supremacy part of it just hid the Patriot movement. It's weird how they used all that hate rhetoric to just be like, oh, it's just a bunch of idiots in the mountains talking about how they hate other races, but actually they were preparing for a war against the U.S. government.
And again, Ruby Ridge and Waco had happened previously. The FBI was kind of licking their wound. They didn't want another situation like that.
Or the ATF.
The ATF specifically.
Yeah, absolutely not. And the ATF not wanting another situation like that is partly what led to Oklahoma City.
But again, Janet Reno, played by Will Ferrell on Saturday Night Live, that was funny.
But before we get to the life and times of Timothy McVeigh and the movement that at the very least inspired him, we're going to cover the actual bombing itself. As we know, a lot of our listeners are either too young to remember or may not have even been born before April 19th, 1995.
God, it makes me so sad. we just had Joey Fatone on set for Your Pretty Face is Going to Hell. It's a bit of a spoiler alert. Calm down, ladies.
I know.
He brought it up that it's the 20th anniversary of NSYNC coming together next year. And
what?
I was like, that's horrible. That's ridiculous.
NSYNC can vote? Oh, no.
NSYNC,
and they were 1 year away from drinking.
NSYNC's been able to vote for 2 years.
Oh,
man.
Where have you been? That's crazy.
But before we get into it, we have to cite our main sources here. The first is American Terrorist by Lou Michael and Dan Herbeck. It's the book that was essentially endorsed by McVeigh. It's where he told his life story, although it still doesn't paint a flattering portrait of McVeigh. This guy was the only guy that McVeigh actually talked to.
There's no way it's going to be a flattering portrait unless it's a pamphlet at a gun show. There's no way you can sugarcoat the story enough to be like, you can't say all the details, but it's like, but also, he could have been an incredible dancer. He had an elegant arch to his feet.
I mean, and as far as haircuts go, he definitely had one.
It was definitive. He was very proud of his brush cut. He called it his brush cut. And that was one of the things that he hated most about being in prison was that he wasn't able to get a good brush cut anymore.
Oh, poor guy.
Sling blade looking country inbred sister fucking piece of shit.
But of course, he was on death row, so this was an opportunity for him to really share his story and get his point of view out there.
Mm-hmm. The other book that we checked out, and this one is the really interesting one, and it only came out a couple years ago after a ton of FBI files were finally released. The other book is Oklahoma City, What the Investigation investigation missed and why it still matters by Andrew Gumbel and Roger Charles. This one refutes McVeigh's story in a number of ways and also gives a fantastic overview of everything that went wrong here.
Okay, interesting.
And the one thing I will say definitely in defense of this book, it has 80 pages of source material, of citing where it gets all of its different points. It's very, very thorough. It's a really cool breakdown. It's a little mind-numbing because it's a lot of details, but it paints a picture of why it was so difficult to investigate this, the incident, and the evidence that points towards there was a whole network that was working with Timothy McVeigh.
And also to prove that this book is valid and reasonable, in those 80 pages of source material, not one of the sources is InfoWars. So that's really, that's good. That's definitive proof.
Guys, hopefully we got to give our support to our boy Alex Jones. Tonight's his big night.
I don't want to talk about
that. His big debut tonight.
We're not talking about the Alex Jones, Megyn Kelly interview.
Well, Alex Jones is a big, speaking of Alex Jones, yes. Oklahoma City is one of Alex Jones's big inside job claims.
Right.
And he says that the entire thing was done to malign the quote-unquote Patriot movement. The Patriot movement is a white supremacist movement. And
ignite for him tonight. I hope he shines. I hope he wins best cinematography. I don't know what he's going to do tonight, but whatever it is going to be fascinating. All eyes on him.
Yeah. But yeah, this is, you know, the start of Alex Jones really starting to get into like inside job bullshit. Like Oklahoma City was one of his first big conspiracy theories.
And that's what we're going to get into here. There were so many different holes in the official narrative. It was able to be filled by conspiracy theorists to then prove whatever point they want to prove, whatever narrative they wanted to create, they were able to create.
Absolutely. And the reason why those holes existed was because of incompetence.
Right.
And through. That's how it always goes with these, is that the holes are always caused by incompetence that the government does not want exposed. It's not that they're trying to not expose evils that they've done. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they are, but most of the time, they're just trying to cover up how badly they fucked up.
That is the great...
Bad investigations leave these incidents sort of like, they become like a Sasha Gray. So many holes to be filled with conspiracy theories, and I think that this, and it's available for it, and it's hungry for it, and it's horny for it.
Okay, well we did manage to get there.
Very good. Yep. Now let's get to the bombing itself. Now that we've got Sasha Gray out of the way,
thank God.
Thank you. It's been burning in my pocket for a while.
That's good. I'm happy it's been released. The genie is out of the bottle.
Now, the site of the bombing was the Alfred P. Mura Federal Building in downtown Oklahoma City. While there were offices for the ATF, Secret Service, and DEA in the building, it was mostly run-of-the-mill government offices. Mm-hmm. It was stuff like Social Security, Housing and Urban Development, Veterans Affairs, Army Recruiting, and just like a lot of other buildings like this, there was a daycare there as well. Mm. 550 people worked at the Mura Building, but that doesn't account for the hundreds who came in and out every day to use basic governmental services, many of whom were there on the morning of April 19th. This was 9 a.m. This place had just opened up. See, McVeigh was faced with a choice. He could very well have set a bomb to explode in the middle of the night when fatalities would be kept to a minimum. But McVeigh didn't want to just destroy a building. He thought that the only way to catch the government's attention would be to rack up a high body count.
Terrorism.
And as far as the loss of innocent life went, McVeigh rationalized it by comparing the people inside to employees on the Death Star.
Woo, woo, woo. We've got a nerd alert. We've got a nerd alert. We've got a nerd alert. Woo, woo.
Another way for George Lucas to get his merchandising.
That's right.
Into American events.
So this is out of Timothy McVeigh's, this is his actual analogy.
This is
he equated them to individuals who worked on the Death Star from Star Wars.
From his mouth. Directly from McVeigh's mouth. In his rationalization, while not every person on the Death Star was individually guilty of crimes against the galaxy, they were still serving on behalf of Emperor Palpatine, in this case represented by Bill Clinton.
It's not
Which
real.
Which I actually really resent, because Emperor Palpatine definitely could not still get an erection.
Oh, absolutely not. Could. He definitely could. To his own detriment.
See, McVeigh thought of himself as Luke Skywalker.
Oh my God. I can't even with this jerk off. I'm like, you know, I am like a little Luke Skywalker, if you think about it.
Well, that's just like Luke Skywalker, because Luke Skywalker also wanted to fuck his sister.
Well,
this is kind of red.
Well, Ben, me and you were kind of talking about stuff like this on the last episode of Top Hat.
Yeah,
where a lot of these people, they want their lives to be movies.
Totally.
They want their lives to be simple movies with bad guys. They want to be the hero, and they want it to all be wrapped up in a nice little package.
And we have 168 innocent dead people because of this moron's trying to live the extension of a film that he loves.
Mm-hmm. Also, Timothy McVeigh was using set up rhetoric. He is parroting things that he has heard. He has sat and thought about the statements he was going to make. All of this is rehearsed. I imagine that they used pop culture in a lot of their recruiting material.
Yeah,
there was a lot of that where it's just like, so it's because it makes it a very simple, attention-grabbing description of your action, and it's so easily printable in a newspaper, which is what they wanted.
Now, by blowing up the Death Star, in this case, represented by the Mira building.
Yeah, can you imagine the daycare of the Death Star?
Yeah.
McVeigh would be seen as a hero, striking back against an evil empire.
It just, it goes back to John Wilkes Booth, you know? He thought the same thing. They all think they're going to be heroes. It never happens that way.
They all die in fire. They all get murdered. Yeah. You're a fucking moron. Yeah. It never works different.
In reality, 80% of the people who died in the blast had no connection whatsoever to law enforcement. They were just regular people going to work in a government job to make ends meet.
Yeah, just trying to get to the weekend so they can go fishing and like try to forget that they work at the Murrow Building.
Yeah.
The exact number is 138 out of 168. Had nothing to do with any one of those apartments. And it's not even just, you're just talking about the ATF too. This is before, this is 9 a.m. This is before the big guys even get in.
Yeah.
You're literally looking at low-level ATF employees. It's fucked up.
So just a little before 9 a.m., Timothy McVeigh, according to him, pulled the yellow Ryder truck on the side of the road and lit the first fuse. Soon after, he lit the second while waiting at a stoplight. He then pulled the Ryder truck into a drop-off point, cut into the sidewalk on the north side of the Mira building, got out, put in a pair of earplugs, and walked towards his getaway car.
Now, apparently, one thing that may have happened is that that was his second plan. That was his backup plan. The first plan is that he was supposed to go into the underground garage underneath the building, but the fucking idiot didn't realize how big the Ryder truck was and spent 15 minutes backing in and out of the front of the fucking parking structure.
God.
And they said, because there was eyewitnesses that say that you see him around driving the Ryder truck because basically he's scrambling to come up with the next plan, which is like, you figure that'd be the first thing. You've been casing a building for months.
Right.
And you didn't fucking think about the stupid truck.
Right. And so now he lit the wick. And I mean, this does take a lot of patience and a lot of calm. I mean, obviously he was calm to be able to drive around with a loaded bomb that was lit.
He was extremely calm the entire time.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
And that's why you were saying earlier, that's why he's not nuts. He's very focused.
Oh, he's not nuts.
He's extremely focused.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's not unstable in any way whatsoever. This man knew exactly what he was doing at every turn and felt good about what he was doing at every turn. Hmm. And McVeigh's getaway car was a pastel 1977 Mercury Marquis that McVeigh had parked just a few blocks away with a note on the window that read, "Not abandoned. Please do not tow. Will move by April 23rd. Needs battery and cables."
And that just shows the confidence of white people that you could just put a note in there. You're like, oh, they'll understand. It's like, everybody understands notes. That's as good as honor. That's an honor code.
Yeah, that is the definition of a dumpy car, though. Whenever you leave it, you're going to be like, not abandoned, by the way. I'm just going to shop at Costco. I will be back in 20 minutes. This car is a functioning car.
I am just a dirtbag.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, you spent $300 on that Mercury Marquis.
Wow.
Pastel yellow, had a big rust spot on it.
He is just the kind of special douchebag that car dealer needed to see that day. He's like, oh, my wife is going to leave me if I don't sell one car, and all I got is this pastel piece of crap. Oh, hello,
man,
Timothy.
Look at this guy's haircut. I'm moving this car tonight.
But before McVeigh could even get to his car, the bomb detonated at 9:02 a.m. with the power of 2.5 tons of TNT. This is a recording of the blast as captured by an audio recording of a routine local government meeting being held in another building.
With regard to this proceeding, basically there are four elements that I have to receive information regarding.
Thank you.
What's so interesting, it is that's just such a great audio description of just it was just a mundane day.
Yeah,
it seemed like a very boring meeting that was going on.
It was a waterboard meeting.
Oh well, that's kind of exciting. but you know, I mean, just this 4/19/1995 was just a day.
Yeah,
and for this to happen, I mean, that is again as we were talking about. This is the definition of terrorism.
And that blast, you know, I mean, it blew out. The blast was loud enough to blow out the recording on this. We had that was loud enough. It was heard over 50 miles away.
Wow.
It's a huge bomb. It's a 20-foot long bomb.
Oh, my God.
Filled with, it's how many tons was that? 5,000 tons?
It was 3.5 tons.
Jesus Christ.
All right.
Yeah. So the explosion was powerful enough so as to cause tiles to fall from ceilings and buildings as far as 3 miles away.
Oh, my God.
The concussive blast shattered windows and buildings all over downtown Oklahoma City, which shredded people on the street. The majority of people who were injured in this were injured by falling glass because all of these windows just went boosh.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Virtually every building in downtown Oklahoma City, over 300 of them, were damaged in some way by the blast, some bad enough where they had to be demolished completely.
Wow.
And when the truck exploded, the force of the blast blew the 250-pound rear axle 2 blocks away, where it hit a car and almost killed the family inside, who coincidentally shared the last name Nichols with McVeigh's known co-conspirator.
Oh, okay.
Interesting. Also, the family, the guy that was an eyewitness testimony said basically it was like an action movie. Heard the blast. He's right. Like with his family. He doesn't go. He looks up and he said he saw this axle just going, making that noise like in a movie, and it just crashed in his car, and he did the good down to his family, was just awesome. He moved very fast.
Yeah,
yeah. That is, what a crazy situation.
Yeah. When the smoke cleared, a third of the 9-story Mira building was rubble, as the concussive effects of the bomb had weakened the concrete columns enough to cause the building to partly collapse.
Hmm. Which is really interesting that I learned about bombs reading Oklahoma City that I never knew, was that it's not so much the initial blast makes a bunch of damage, but then it creates a vacuum, this like negative pressure effect where it sucks back in. All the air comes in to fill the space that the concussive energy like pushed out. And that's what bring all the, and that's what they're saying, that's where Timothy McVeigh was accidentally a genius, because he did not understand the physics of what he was doing.
Yeah.
And that he somehow tricked his way into making it ended up being extra powerful, because it's like 2 blasts in one, which is also why the conspiracy theories are going to say that there were 2 bombs.
Mm-hmm. All right. When there absolutely was not. Now, the heat from the blast set cars in the parking lot across the street on fire, and the ground was littered with bodies and body parts. But the worst part was the children. Just above the Ryder truck on the second floor of the building was the America's Kids Daycare Center. The kids inside were infants, toddlers, and preschoolers. 21 kids were in the daycare that day. Only 6 survived, and 19 kids throughout the building would die in the blast. McVeigh would later say that he regretted the children, but never expressed any remorse whatsoever. In his words, the children, as well as the non-governmental workers, 69 people who were just there to get their Social Security check or some other bullshit that day, were nothing more than collateral damage.
He is ridiculous.
That's the words that he used specifically.
Well, he learned a lot of that from his time in the Gulf War, and he had this kind of whole concept of like that was the part of it that was going to incite the race war. That was what was going to finally do it. That's what he wanted. He wanted that. So he never even he saying the terms that he regretted it. He didn't give a shit.
I don't know. It's a little controversial, but we talked about this on Top Head as well with regarding Dylann Roof. We got to ban people with bad haircuts. I really believe we need cameras in every barber. And every time someone comes in, who's like, "What does he call his haircut?"
The brush.
The brush. Put him on a list. Now you're on a list.
Top down problem. Cut the head off the snake. That's what I say.
Cut the hair off.
Cut off the snake.
That's it.
Rescuers were on the scene immediately and headed straight into the wreckage. They said both the ceilings and the floors were marked by large circles of coagulated blood.
Oh.
Each circle marking a human being that had been crushed by the falling concrete slabs.
No one deserves to die that way. That's for sure.
One woman who fell 5 stories survived but was trapped and kept her composure by squeezing the severed hands of one of the other victims, saying it made her feel oddly comforted while waiting to be set free.
Oh, my God.
It was
God.
The only thing she had.
Interesting, yeah.
If she were the last podcast on the left fan, she would have called it an Ed Gein stress ball.
That's true.
Inappropriate.
I mean, it's a bit of dark humor, but that is, I mean, how interesting. What a strange situation.
It is a bit of dark humor.
It's a bit of a midnight chuckle, as they call it.
Yeah, a little midnight chuckle. But what a strange situation to have to be in, and for her to have to experience that is really,
And she said she knew that she had reached out. She was trapped under rubble, and she reached out and found someone else's hand and started squeezing it, and looked over that, you know, and saw that the hand was attached to nothing else. And she said that she didn't particularly care at the time. She said she needed something to hold on to, because that was another thing that some of the survivors inside said. They said while they were waiting to be rescued, they said it wasn't like an action movie where you've got like hissing pipes and rubble falling and people screaming. They said it was deathly silent in there.
Yeah. Interesting.
Now, one of the most tragic stories was that of Dana Bradley. She, accompanied by three members of her family, was at the Social Security office to get her son a Social Security card that day, her brand new baby boy. Mm. And when the truck bomb exploded, Dana's mother, daughter, and son were all dead.
Oh, my
and her
God.
Sister was badly burned. Dana herself was trapped under the rubble and had to have her leg amputated at the knee with a pocket knife.
Oh, my goodness.
It was so fucked up, because they literally had to go to the triage center, and they grabbed the ER doctor that was the head of the department that was there at 9 o'clock in the morning. And they grabbed him, and they have to do this, and he was a very fat man. And they said that he had to struggle his way through. They could barely get through the rubble to get to her in the position. So he was like, he had to do it with his left hand, which was not his strong hand. And all of his scalpels kept breaking because he couldn't use anesthesia on her because her blood pressure was too low. He was afraid that the anesthesia would kill her. Mm. So he used a tranquilizer, just being like, you're just going to have to deal with this, and we're just going to make good, but I have to keep you still for me to do this. And so it was just him, every break, she was completely motionless, screaming, and he used his scalpel. Each one kept breaking until finally he got someone's pocket knife and managed to finally get the last tendon, because he had to cut through the worst part of her knee, like the most complicated part. And that's fucking horrible.
Not a good day for anyone. I mean, this was an act of war, and that reminds me of a scene out of a hospital from the Civil War.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just, oh my goodness, limbs everywhere.
Yeah, Dana, along with most of the other trapped survivors, were down in the basement, which rescuers dubbed the pit, because burst pipes were slowly filling it with freezing cold water, which made the rescue process all the more urgent.
It's never good when where you are has been dubbed the pit. Very rarely is that like that. Oh, that means we're having a better time than other people?
Unless you're at the People's Improv Theater on 29th Street in New York City, the pit, where you could get cheap improv classes and even cheaper comedy shows.
That's right.
And it was incredibly dangerous to be in there as well.
Well, one thing also interesting in the first wave of looking for survivors is that there was all this money everywhere, because the ATF offices, their evidence room blew up. Mm. So money and guns are everywhere, and these confused officers are running around like trying to save people, but also just picking up just handfuls of cash. And eventually, like, the commanders had to say, leave the fucking money, we're getting these people. It was very complicated.
Yeah, a surreal scene.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, after the 2-week rescue attempt was over, only a handful of people had been saved from the rubble. Mm. And predictably, just like with the construction of the World Trade Center, most of these deaths could have been prevented for just a few dollars more.
All right.
The columns of the Alfred P. Murrah Building were reinforced with rebar. Had the building used hoop steel instead, a change that would have accounted for 0.8% of the construction budget, the building would not have collapsed, which is how the majority of the lives were lost. Mm. Had the government spent just $18,000 more on this contract, no more than 20 people would have died, as opposed to 168.
The government, you know, they probably did this under the guise of cutting the budget. Mm-hmm. But then
that's exactly what they did.
Yeah.
Because the whole point is the reason why they wanted to use hoop steel, because that was earthquake proofing the buildings. And they were like, oh, there's hardly any earthquakes here. And also, they didn't want to make it some big oppressive government building, because you had HUD there and you had the Social Security office. So they wanted it to be this kind of friendly place. And the reason why now all buildings, like if you tried to go into the new World Trade Center, if you try to go in there, you are frisked. I'm treated like a criminal as you go in there, because that's this is why now, because now every government building has to be completely made to this specific code. And also the idea that you could even get a van that close to the building is really insane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's absolutely insane that he was allowed to park right up in front of it. Not just right up in front of it, mm-hmm. but right below the daycare center. Because the daycare center was directly above where Timothy McVeigh parked the Ryder truck. And in fact, when he got out of the truck, he would have been able to look up and see kids' drawings in the window of that.
So you think
building.
That he knew it was a daycare center?
He absolutely knew.
Okay. He cased the building before. Yeah. They said that he came in weeks before. We'll go into the next episode, but he came in asking about the back entrances to the daycare and was very interested in how many people were there. And also, there was a controversial change of management of the daycare that caused a lot of people to not bring in their kids that day, which is very interesting, too, is that a lot more kids could have died, but the woman that everybody loved had just left, and they had a new boss there, like a new runner of the daycare, and they didn't trust that person, so they didn't. A lot of people didn't bring their kids.
Yeah, it was just a stroke of luck that that worked out that way. Furthermore, the Mura building only had one guard on duty at any one time, and the building was actually left totally unguarded for 5 hours a day. Now, while there was no possibility that McVeigh knew of the structural weaknesses, he sure as hell knew about the holes in security and chose Oklahoma City over buildings in Omaha and Dallas, partly because of that. Because the people in Omaha and Dallas, you weren't able to drive a truck right up to the front entrance of it.
I gotta say, the only way that it would be acceptable for the Murrow building to have one security guard is if that security guard was the dad from Family Matters. Because you know he would have done a great job protecting that building.
I'm getting too old for this shit. I mean, just taking a shit.
And while most people around the world were flabbergasted that this happened in Oklahoma City of all places, local law enforcement officials knew that something like this could happen, and to their credit, tried to prevent it. The local head of the Federal Protective Services, whose whole job is to protect places like the Mura building, put together a detailed report outlining each and every one of the Mura building's vulnerabilities. But his bosses wanted to keep the building as, quote, a place where people wanted to do business.
Right.
They said that terrorism was something that just didn't happen in America, and ordered the agent to change his report. And
well, apparently also did not build up goodwill amongst his bosses, because he'd been harping on this for a long time, and they all just thought he was really fucking annoying. Mm-hmm, and he didn't, so then at some point they finally just wrote him off.
But I do understand if you are, you know, a person in a pre-Oklahoma City bombing world or a pre-9/11 world, you know, you do want people to feel comfortable. And it was, I mean, it's what happened after Columbine when it came to sort of hardening high schools, making them hard targets for people to attack. I mean, I understand the perspective of the people who are running this building to make it a family-friendly environment that wasn't militant.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, they didn't know.
There's a middle ground, though.
Yeah.
There's absolutely a middle ground between like frisking people as they go inside to get a driver's license and leaving an entire front entrance completely open for somebody.
Yeah. And the security cameras were fake. They weren't connected to anything. So there was no footage of the actual bombing. I will say at least one Dwight Schrute a year saves 50 people.
Oh, I mean, if Dwight was in that office building,
he complains about how the line at the Chipotle is too long.
That's it.
But he will maybe save you.
Yeah, it reminds me of Wayne's World, where he's at the video shoot. He's like, there is no film in this camera, but then of course there is. But again, that also plays into the conspiracy theories. The conspiracy theorists were just allowed to fill so many pockets of information that weren't filled by reports and cameras.
Yeah.
So stop saying holes.
Holes.
And this is another thing that played into the conspiracy theorists' ideas that, you know, something was being covered up here, because this agent who put out this report that the Mura building was vulnerable to an attack, he did change his report, his official report. He changed it, and when the bombing happened, his bosses made damn sure he wasn't anywhere near Oklahoma City, because shit, he might have talked to the press. He might have said something like, yeah, I told him that this was unsafe. I told him that something like this could happen. But they ended up shifting him from building to, or from agency to agency to agency. Mm. And they did that with a lot of people around Oklahoma City. People were being shifted all around to cover up incompetence.
Well, that's the interesting thing. And I know we'll get into this a little bit more in the future. When it comes to, in the future episodes, when it comes to conspiracy theories, oftentimes they think the government has, like, you know, total competence enough to actually perpetrate an act like this. In reality, like you just said, it's the incompetence of the government that allows these things to happen.
I could work at the ATF. You know what I mean?
You have the body for it.
I could go and apply for a job at the government. There are men like me out there that are working for the government that don't know what they're doing.
Which is not shocking to anybody.
Yeah. They should be actors. They should be performers. They shouldn't be at a cubicle.
Well, that's the thing about the United States government is that it is full of absolutely competent and not just competent, but heroes, people who deserve to be in those positions of power that are there to help people. They're there because they don't want people to die.
Right.
But government is also, it's a human institution. So it's going to be filled with a lot of people who are neglectful fuck-ups that don't necessarily give a fuck about anybody else besides their own ass.
So let's get
back. There were people in this story that did really good jobs. Yeah. They just kind of got silenced after the fact because there were people like deep within the, we're going to get into the white supremacist movement, like the people that knew that this shit was coming and were saying like, hey, they are preparing for something. There was a lot of buzz. It was the same thing before 9/11. So like there's a lot of reports coming out saying like there's a lot of bustling happening. I don't know what's going on. And it's just what information they choose to act on.
Right. All right. So Timothy McVeigh, where are we at now?
Right now.
He's in his pastel car.
Yeah, absolutely. So when the hunt for suspects began, America looked first to the Middle East, which was actually pretty logical at the time because Ramzi Youssef, the mastermind of the first World Trade Center bombing that had just happened a year before Oklahoma City, he'd just been apprehended. And the jihadist groups, of course, had promised swift retaliation.
Right.
And really, it was the only explanation that we had that made any sense to us, because shit like this didn't happen in America. And if it did, it was always someone from somewhere else who was the perpetrator. I remember when this happened, because I grew up pretty close to Oklahoma City. And I remember, you know, to my parents' work, and they were like watching it on the TV that day and were absolutely shocked that anything like this could happen.
Yeah.
And I remember when when Timothy McVeigh was captured, it was a look of like pain on their face. Like,
he looked like somebody, everyone had it, someone who looked like Timothy McVeigh in their hometown.
Yeah.
You know?
He looked like, like a dipshit.
That's basically it. The kind of guy that you talk bad about behind his back, but in front of his face, you're visibly terrified.
Damn.
Well, going to the Tim! Patriot movement.
Tim, no, we're not having a barbecue this Sunday. So, wait. You heard about it.
You don't want to hear about the coming revolution. Also, I'll bring coleslaw.
But the Patriot movement, it's like the multiplicity clone of the Nazi movement. Literally, it's a bunch of idiots that Goebbels would have spit on if he had met.
But during the investigation, it wasn't long before someone remembered the date. Mm. April 19th, 2 years to the day after the siege at Waco had come to a deadly and fiery end. Hmm.
But that was Bob Ricks, the head of the FBI in Oklahoma, who technically should have been in charge of the investigation. But we're going to find out there was a lot of corruption with who was being put in charge. But he understood. As soon as he saw it popped, he was like, they were sitting in the office, and he was like, this is the second year anniversary of Waco. And they're all like, oh, shit. Like, because he knew that this was coming. And then we're going to talk about they knew that there were a bunch of people pissed off about Ruby Ridge and that Waco got so much attention, being like, of course, it's going to be, it's what 420 is now. It's what we talked about with Columbine. And we did that whole episode. Yes.
Not the weed holiday. Yes, not the weed holiday.
Legalize it. Legalize weed.
Yes.
Man, if these guys just had fucking weed, man.
I don't think Timothy McVeigh would have done good with weed. He would have been bad on weed.
He actually tried weed and meth for a brief period. It wasn't for him.
Oh, he did a lot of Timothy meth. Apparently, McVeigh. That was one of the things. The fuel up to the building of the bomb is that him and he was trying. McVeigh was trying to get Nichols into meth. McVeigh had been up for days leading up to here, which probably is why he fucked up with the license plate, which we'll get into.
We'll get into it.
So the FBI, they drew up a little profile. The Behavioral Sciences Unit drew something up. They said the perpetrator would be a white male with military experience who was angry about Ruby Ridge and Waco, described him perfectly. And from then on, the attack was what the FBI referred to as a, quote, Bubba job.
Interesting.
Which used to be the term for when you blow yourself with a dead fish on a boat with your buddy watching. He's like, you come yet?
That's a Bubba job, huh? Well, isn't that wild?
So moments after the bomb went off, McVeigh hopped into his Mercury Marquis, but he couldn't get the car to start because he bought a $300 car.
Right.
And he tried again and again to get the engine to turn over until finally it started and he sped away.
Right.
But McVeigh had either forgotten or had purposely left something important off his car. McVeigh, who had just murdered 168 people, was driving down the road without any license plates on his car.
It is ridiculous. It reminds me of that Ted Bundy quote where it's like...
We talk about it all the time.
Yeah, mm-hmm. After the 20th kill, you forget where you put your wrench or something like that. But it's just so strange to me that he would make this mistake on accident. It seems like this was a purposeful decision to get caught because he wanted to be a martyr, right?
It's possible. So a state trooper named Charles Hanger noticed this about 60 miles north of Oklahoma City and pulled McVeigh over. And when McVeigh got out of the car, the officer noticed a bulge in McVeigh's jacket. When the officer reached inside, he found a handgun, and Timothy McVeigh was arrested for the first time in his life for the unlawful carrying of a firearm. But the funny thing was, Hanger had no idea who he had handcuffed in the back of his cop car. But there was a clue. When McVeigh was arrested, he was wearing his favorite T-shirt that he wore special for that day. Ugh. On the front was a picture of Abraham Lincoln with the words, "Sic semper tyrannis, thus ever to tyrants," printed underneath. These were the words that John Wilkes Booth had screamed after shooting Lincoln in the head.
"Sic semper tyrannis."
Mm-hmm.
It also tyrannis. Sounds like...
But I will say "Sic semper tyrannis" was also made famous by the Sondheim musical Assassins that John Wilkes Booth has a wonderful solo in, and I love it. I sing it alone all the time.
My brother was in the play Assassins in college.
Really?
I got to see it. Yes, he was a very tall, tall person in the play.
And on the back of the shirt was a picture of a tree featuring a quote from Thomas Jefferson that said,
"The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants." But not mine. Certainly not mine.
Yeah.
I own my girlfriend. Did you know?
Just the world's like worst farmer. Be like, "What are you putting on the crops there? Human blood.
The blood of patriots and tyrants.
She is killing all the trees. Maybe I got this wrong."
Now, I checked online, and you can still get your very own Sic Semper Tyrannis shirt, but now, instead of just a boring old tree, you can get one with a sexy lady on it instead.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah, just go to Gadsden and Culpepper's American Heritage Shop, the official Don't Tread on Me outfitter.
A sexy lady just like Abraham Lincoln loved. He loved sexy ladies.
I'm going to go home and have sex with the first lady.
I can't wait to go shopping there because the sound hood I'm wearing currently is very warm.
Yes.
And I think that they probably have a whole collection of very breezy hoods for me to wear with face holes cut out perfectly for hiding sound.
Uh-huh.
You could also buy a deck of cards with girls in swimsuits holding guns. You know what it's called?
What?
Guns and buns.
Guns and buns.
That, wow.
Because every time I play poker, I also want to be reminded that I'm lonely.
Yeah.
I only like hot babes on my playing cards.
Yeah, I love being vaguely hard while I'm playing cards.
Me and my buddies, sometimes my father is there.
Oh,
I love this.
Yeah, the sexual fetish of guns is so weird to me, but that's a whole other thing.
Well, of course it is. They're penises with bullets in it.
I guess.
About how, if you could make your semen hard, that would be so much fun. Go bing, ding, dong, bing, ding, dong. Like off like different surfaces in your house, like little BB gun.
I think it's best that doesn't happen.
So it wouldn't take authorities long to catch up to Timothy McVeigh. The first break came when the rear axle of the Ryder truck was found two blocks away, the same one that almost took the heads off the family huddled in their car for safety.
Hmm.
The axle had a VIN number stamped on it, which was traced to a place called Elliott's Body Shop in Junction City, Kansas. Hmm. When they checked the paperwork, they found that the truck had been rented to a man named Robert Kling, one of McVeigh's aliases.
Okay.
But when the body shop employees were interviewed, they found that McVeigh may not have been alone when he rented it. Ooh. This claim has become one of the most contentious points in the whole Oklahoma City saga. Sketches were done of both men, with the first one undoubtedly being of McVeigh's square-headed possum sourpuss.
Yeah.
He really is such a sourpuss.
Yeah, he is.
He does not smile.
No.
He's a tight-faced little fucking prick.
But you know for a fact he would be just like that couple who were laughing, like furiously laughing, and I looked over on the airplane, and they were watching Frasier. I have a feeling Timothy McVeigh would be like, "I don't like comedy, but Frasier, he gets me every time."
But the other sketch was of a heavy set man in a Carolina Panthers cap with olive skin.
Hmm.
That man, to this day, is still known as John Doe number two.
Okay.
Who we'll get into on the next episode. Either way, the sketches were taken from door to door in Junction City until finally a woman who worked at a local motel called Dreamland recognized sketch number one. You look like you want to say something about Dreamland.
Dreamland? No, it's just like, we got rooms. You can rent them by the hour, or you can rent them by the half hour.
This is some kind of Dreamland.
Like, it's just obviously, it's obviously not a place. Like, they must have been stunned. He's like, I'll spend the night. The night, sir? We've never had someone spend the night here at Dreamland.
Wait a second. Are you a millionaire? Or do you just have nothing to lose?
When they checked the register, they found the name Timothy McVeigh.
Hmm.
They also found
but
that...
What a fucking idiot.
Well,
he used his real name. He's just such a... He's just... The idea that he could do anything alone. We'll talk about this. Well, but it's just... He's so fucking square-headed and stupid. And,
I literally think he ran out of creative juices. And he's like, well, what's an alias? I already did Robert Kling. Timothy McVeigh. That's my name.
Richard Kring.
What about Timothy McVeigh? Oh, that's my name. Dang it.
I never understand people having a hard time. I'm coming up with fake names. I could come up with fake names all day long.
Go.
Jim Anderson, Jim Sanderson, Jim Randerson, John Randerson, John Anderson. You just keep coming up with names.
Robert Bimbo.
Marcus Parks.
Robert Bingbong.
Mr. Robert Bingbong.
My name is Horatio Fernandez. Hi, hello. My name is Horatio Fernandez. I say immediately, I just jump into character. But that's because I'm a character comedian.
Yes, that's true. Yes, I think I don't think that Timothy McVeigh had the improv or the sketch abilities.
No,
so he would have really not done well at Just for Laughs in Montreal.
No, definitely not.
They also found that McVeigh had listed his address as a farm in Michigan, which belonged to the brother of Terry Nichols, McVeigh's possible lone conspirator in the official version of the events. And while agents went to check out the farm, a computer check was run on the name Timothy McVeigh and his recent arrest in Oklahoma less than an hour and a half after the bombing the previous Wednesday showed up.
Hmm.
Lucky for them, the judge who was meant to see McVeigh that Thursday had a full schedule, and so McVeigh's bail hearing was pushed to Friday.
Hmm.
Had that not happened, McVeigh would have been set free, and who knows how long it would have taken to find him or what McVeigh would have done in the meantime.
Well, it would have been another Ruby Ridge situation. You know, it would have been a Waco-esque standoff that would have led to a horrible, horrific events with God knows, like you just said, how many other people would have died.
Unless he had a place to go. And it was set up, and he was supposed to go and meet up with a network of people that were supposed to hide him, which is a theory that they've done that before. They took criminals. There was a whole criminal underground that we're going to get into in the next episode.
Mm-hmm. We'll get into it.
But thankfully, McVeigh was arrested again and charged with the bombing. So now we've got some questions to answer. Number one, who was Timothy McVeigh?
A fuckface. Shit.
Those are the quick answers.
Bad dresser. Bad speaker. Bad lover. Maybe a good friend.
Maybe. I don't think he was a good friend. I think he was a very pushy, mean friend. But.
He was a very bad lover. He did not do well with the ladies at all. The best that he ever did.
I wouldn't have guessed that.
I know. This is stunning revelations from last podcast on the left. Timothy McVeigh. Bad in bed.
Do you think that he maybe was bad at cunnilingus?
I think he was bad at about everything.
The best he ever did was... After the Gulf War, right after he got back, he tried a line on a girl, walked up to a girl at a bar and said, hey, do you need a special license to wear that outfit?
I'm going to go talk to another man, not you. You freak. Why are you here?
Kill all the women. Kill all the women. They don't get my charm. I'm the most charming man in the world.
And him and Elliot Rodgers start hanging out.
Exactly.
Number two. How did he get to this point?
He's an idiot, gullible. He had no skills. He was destroyed by the war. We'll get to the
short answers again.
I'm enjoying Henry's quick hot takes on it.
And number three, who else was involved?
Yes.
I tell you what, I certainly hope it's not Big Bird from Sesame Street, because that was the last honest thing. That was like the last good thing. Him and Mr. Rogers. If Mr. Rogers shows up somewhere in this investigation, I'm going to be very upset.
Absolutely. No, those are great questions, and we're going to answer those on the next episode, because, I mean, that's how we find, that's how we avoid these future acts, you know, going forward here. We have to find the root problem, and that's what we talked about on Top Hat as well in this last episode. Contentious right now, and it is social media driven, and it's interesting to see these people.
Or we just continue doing what we've always done and what we will continue to do, which is ignore the problem, let it grow like a cancer in our bellies until it destroys the entire country, which I think at this point it's like, I mean, it's going to happen. So let's just have fun with it.
Well, let's not. Let's try to avoid it. At all costs, we could all try to avoid this.
Well, we can see with Oklahoma City and the kind of gun show culture that was going on in the 90s and in the 80s, with, you know, these, you can trace a line from what's going on now with both sides way back to the 80s and 90s.
Totally.
Like, you know, when people say, like, how did the country get so divided all of a sudden?
Yeah.
All of a sudden, are you fucking kidding me?
Right.
This is shit that has been bubbling for decades.
Yep.
And Timothy McVeigh is right in the middle of all of it.
And I think one thing that could save us, honestly, is that if, quote unquote, right now, if it's true, the Patriot Movement technically has their president. They have it now. You got a couple of real white supremacists that are in the White House that are, they're a part of making policy. And so they're watching them fuck it up. And it's kind of fun, because I think it's going to take the steam out of their fucking ship a little bit, realizing now you guys got the job and you're not doing it right.
They love what they're doing. So that's kind of the sad truth.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are different perspectives, Henry. There are more than one.
Yeah. They're actually extremely happy with what's going on right now. They have never been happier in their entire lives.
Oh my goodness. All right. Well, that's episode one, Oklahoma City. We got a lot more to get to, a lot to cover with this story. It's an intense one, and I think more relevant than ever, really, with our current times. And let's take a look at these domestic terrorists, and we got to nip it in the bud before we have another act like this.
Yeah, without a doubt. Yeah.
If anybody else, if you meet anybody that gives you the Turner Diaries, you got to run. They are not your friend. They're not your friend.
It's not about Tina Turner. It's not fun.
I'm going to say we've been called a problematic fave. I'm going to call the Turner Diaries a problematic fave. Because it is, it's a doozy.
Yeah, I actually don't really want you reading the Turner Diaries, to be fair. You've sort of adopted some Scientology lingo, and
absorb
everything.
This is different. I'm reading the Turner Diaries on my computer and look up in the mirror and see me dressed as Gary, literally as the White Devil, reading this book, and controversial.
All right, and check out Your Pretty Face is Going to Hell, of course.
Yeah.
Everyone, thank you so much for listening. Let's see, we got to do Patreon. Thank everyone so much for donating to the Patreon. You're the only reason that we can do this and travel all around and do the live shows. I want to thank everybody in Indianapolis. We had an incredible time at CrimeCon.
Oh, CrimeCon
was
great.
That was so fun. So we'll definitely, whenever we're invited, we will be there for CrimeCon, I hope, anyway.
It was fun to see that CrimeCon, we were surprised that it was sponsored by Oxygen, and I thought it was great. And also, most of CrimeCon was the little ladies from The Keepers.
Oh, yes.
Old ladies.
There was one adorable old lady who came, because we were selling t-shirts, and one adorable old lady was like, I don't know what you boys do, but are you interested in a cold case?
It really was trippy.
And she pulls out, pulls out her little folder and gives me this one sheet that has all of the information about her pet cold case on it.
She's found this knife in the gut of a dead girl. Ma'am?
I don't know, ma'am. Did you kill her, ma'am?
You, ma'am?
Yes. No, that was unbelievable. What a fun group of people.
Yeah.
And everyone could come together and not feel weird. And, you know, that's always so great.
And great to meet a lot of our fellow podcasters out there.
Yep.
You guys are awesome. Yeah, it's cool to see there's like a little true crime podcast community out there.
Absolutely. And we want to thank everyone that came out to Hi-Fi the venue. It was incredible.
Hi-Fi, that was one of my favorite shows ever.
Love it.
Also, the Crime Con had such a funny thing of like a fake chalk outline of a victim.
Oh,
these old ladies are up there taking pictures of me. I'm like, don't you fantasize about this. You're the victim.
The sad thing is I walked by it and I was like, I'm too big to be the victim. And we saw sniffer dogs, cadaver dogs, which are so cute.
Do.
But I say, give them a break. You know, let them clock out. But they were incredible.
They were. They bounded around when they ran.
They did. But then it's like when they do achieve like their great accomplishment, it's just a dead body they have to find. Give them a
and they're
pizza.
Laughing and they're they're wagging their tail like, it's a mutilated corpse.
It's such a...
Also, felt a bit nervous being like, I had weed. I didn't even realize it. I had weed in my pocket when we walked into the drug dog sanitarium.
Oh, I'm my just like, God.
Oh, fuck.
There's just a how did Henry die? Drug dogs. They took him down.
Oh, Henry, those were cadaver dogs. You were fine.
Yeah. Yeah, Marcus is the one with the human thumb in his pocket.
I don't have thumb, human. No.
All right, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. Let's see, Patreon. We got to thank everyone for that.
Yeah, thanks everyone for giving our Patreon. If you feel like we deserve a little bit of cash for what we do here, you can go and give at patreon.com/lastpodcastontheleft. If you give just $1, you get advanced ticket sales to all of our upcoming shows. We've got a lot of shows that we're about to announce here in just the next couple of days. So go follow us on Twitter to see when we announce those.
That's right. And the Twitter is at LP on the left. You can find Henry on Twitter at Henry loves you. Dr. Fantasty on Instagram. Marcus Sparks is Marcus Sparks for everything. I'm Ben Kissel and Ben Kissel 1 on Instagram.
Yeah, so fucking check out your bullshit. Hail Satan and fucking try just cut your rage. Don't plan a terrorist attack. That's write a book. Do something else. Have fun with it. You know, play a song.
Play a song. Write a wonderful poem.
Make your own kind of music.
That's what I've
even
always said.
Even if nobody else sings along.
That is what people do on the train on a regular basis.
Make your own kind of music.
That's not...
Sing your own special song.
And thanks for supporting all the shows here on CCR. Hail yourselves.
Hail me.
Hail Gene.
And among constellations. Let's do it. All right, it's time for Patreon shoutouts. Thanks, everyone who donated. Hail yourselves, Magustalations. You're all the best.
Shout out. Away from Patreon.
All right. You guys are the only reason we exist, and we all love you very much. Okay, I will begin reading some names. Daniel Gorman. Thank you so much, Daniel. Thomas Barton. Pat Brown. Damon Tang. Daniel Kurzak. Daniel Kurzak. Sounds like a good military man. Kurzak!
Get in here, Kurzak!
Gosh darn it, I've done something
I dropped the mortars!
Not good. Matt Kelly, Justin Burkard, Ryan Jones, Katie Aldahl Welch, Thomas Llewellyn? Llewellyn? I feel like I've read that one before. Thomas Llewellyn?
Llewellyn.
Llewellyn. Also a very fun name. Tristan Tate, Vladimir. Oh my goodness, Marcus, this one's Russian. You have to read it. Vladimir Vojnik? Vojnovic? I think it's Vojnovic. Vladimir Vojnovic.
Vladimir Vojnovic.
Cool. Thank you, buddy.
You're welcome.
Yeah, dude, we have a bunch of Russians staying in the building where I'm staying here, and it makes me very paranoid. I don't know if they're going to send my secrets.
Are you
taking my secrets?
If they took your secrets, they would be the dumbest people in Russia when they go back. Chase Griffin, Hanel Plotkin, Bree Howard, Thomas Edward, Ben Pulowski, Lindsay Aramo, Corin Brandenburg, Melissa Nottingham, and Honor Mayro is kind of cut off there. I believe it's Honor Mayor.
TJ Hera, Holly Hudson, Torsten Neusenberg, Frankie, Courtney Cochran,
Hello.
Ainsley Ezra, Clinton Hallahan. Niam, who I believe is our friend in that we met in Glasgow, who is from Scotland. So, hey there.
It's good to see you. Good evening.
Brandon Rowland, Sarah McGuire.
I got Daniel Shipley.
All right.
Tina Pettis.
Okay.
Nah Kalar.
Mm-hmm.
Kellen, it's N-A-A.
Klingon?
Non-Kalar?
Nah Kalar.
Can we trust him?
Damn you, Kirk.
Kellen R. Adachi, Byron Carlisle, Tony Stark.
Really?
Tony Stark.
You better have given us more than $1. That billionaire.
Iron Man. It's Iron Man.
I'm a big fan of Last Podcast on the Left. I listen to it in my suit every day.
Danielle Rosler. Johannes Van Velzen. Kiki Adirante. Gabriel Laplace. Albie. Ellie Skipper. Andrew Turkic. I think it's Turkic.
All right, Turkic.
Alex Cantrell, Christopher Wormald, Megan DeLeon, Mitch Wheeler, Kenny Shackelford, Lindsay Dapp, Jessica, and TJ Hera.
Thank you all so much. Okay, I've got a fella. His name is Evan Bourbon, which is kind of fun. Bourbon, which I like. Evan Bourbon. Chelsea Stumpf. Anathasia Mapes. Anathasia Mapes. I love that name. Anathasia, if I'm saying that remotely close to right, I like that name. Okay. Kevin L. Gouge. Audrey Lewis. Mike Haranda. Jane Andraka. Ian Price. Hillary Leanne. I believe it's Hillary Leanne. Tristan Powers. Christina Lindsay. Marissa Smith. Blake Bonafide. Daniel Zach. Emil Majoris. I believe it's Emil Majoris. Laura Abraham. Preston Snow. Lo Grant. Michael Newdine. Caitlin Hadley. Nico Mora. I feel like Oprah. I want to give them all cars. You get a car.
Tori and David McIlwain. Caitlin Usselman. Ian Palazzi.
Ooh.
Simon Pickus. Alex Dybel. Jesse Chandler. Alexandria Scott. Michelle Opert. Treby, Nick Morris,
okay.
Jennifer Seifring, Zach Donahoe, Ryan Reynolds.
Ooh,
no.
That's the Green Lantern. We've got the Green Lantern and Iron Man listening to the show.
He's better as Deadpool, so let's
Deadpool.
Keep it.
Oh, yeah. Deadpool.
So, yeah, Green Lantern?
That's Green Lantern. Don't you. He will always be my Green Lantern.
Ryan Reynolds, will you please come and take me out of this? Please just come and just save me. I'll do anything. I'll lick up your cum on your wife if you want to.
Yeah,
that's what I'll do.
I'll
be your little towel.
If you could be the chubby sidekick to Ryan Reynolds in a superhero movie, you'd be set.
Please make it happen, Ryan Reynolds.
Nick Aldridge, Jared Hoon, Ali Sante, Benjamin Weisberg, Angela Cortese, Dominic D'Agostino, Kimberly, and Angela Hauser.
I got Jameson Paulson, Brock Bender, Stuart Browning, Sergio, the French Stuart victim, the French Stuart killer. Randy Gates, Shauna Lawler, Michael Meyer, Rebecca Anderson, Jake, Savannah Wells, MJ Hall, Peter Baker, John Romero, Ash Lee.
Oh.
It's Ash
yeah,
Lee.
Yeah, I like that.
Oh, yeah.
Craig Allen, Ethan Swicegood.
All right.
Jonas Missing A Show in Sweden, Nelson.
Oh, okay.
I guess he wants us to do a show in Sweden.
Okay, we'll do it.
I'd love to go to Sweden.
We would love to go to Sweden.
Please.
That's my accent of it.
Trevor Hine and Favor.com.
All right, Favor.com. Thank you so much. Alex, I got Alex Gutierrez. Dalton Wortman. George Lucas. I can't make this stuff up. We got George Lucas here.
Do we really get him to?
I don't know.
Save us.
I'm a really big fan of Last Podcast on the Left. I just have to say that all of you are, I'm big fans.
Did you make Jar Jar Binks exist?
I love him.
You know what? I like Jar Jar Binks too. I'm just going to say it, and I said it yesterday. It's Coney Island, and people.
Jar Binks was really our way of getting a Rastafarian man as racistly as possible into the Star Wars genre. And it's been big for us.
They were like, we need to diversify this cast. We're like, we could cast an Asian person or maybe an African American. They're like, I got an idea.
What are you talking about? They did cast an Asian person. A Jedi here.
I'm not even.
Oh no, this is a horrible.
This is.
He's doing it.
I know. I know.
That was the characters of the.
Oh, we have betrayed the Federation.
All right. George Lucas, thank you. Lacey Schwindenhammer. I love that name. Schwindenhammer. Lacey. Chloe Rush. Keir Nathan. Jumbo Jet Timmons. Zane Diltz. Larissa DeMarco. Katie Fitch. UKHC. Gina Forte. James Kakarook. Oh, Kokorikis. James Kokorikis. I like that. Kokorikis. Andrew Robinson. Aaron Thomas. Hector Trujillo.
Trujillo.
Let me see it.
Hector Trujillo? Right there.
Yeah.
Trujillo.
Hector.
Trujillo.
How do you roll the...
Trujillo.
Just have anything but white in you. Literally,
I can't do it. I am from Wisconsin.
You just go...
That is me attempting to do anything that is not Midwestern. Hector Trujillo. Whatever. Henry, hold Marcus, you said it. Kevin Lovett. Janine. Katie Robinson. Adam Murphy. And Sarah Blum. Thank you so much.
Now, I will say this. If you are looking for a fake name, this is a very easy way to get one. You listen to the Patreon shoutouts and just choose one. Emily Reed, Robert Jordan, Lena Weinberg. It's got an umlaut on it. Weinberg. Christina Carls, Brian Houghton, Robert John Parry the Fourth.
Wow.
God. What? One of the co-conspirators with Timothy McVeigh. Danielle Pugliese. Brandon Nunez. Dan Bunyan. Chad Williford. Chance Kennedy. Ooh. Hi, I'm Chance Kennedy, and this is your Action Sports. Oh, my God. Bobby Bonilla.
That is your only sports reference to this day.
Wait, Bobby Bonilla gives to our Patreon?
What? No.
Oh, that would be amazing. If we got
I'm reaching out to him, though.
Okay, please do.
Michael Brown, Matthew McDowell, Margaret McMillan, Alyssa Karras, Anna Cox, Parker Joseph Sestaric, Emily Fishman,
all right.
Matthew Schmidt. Thank you for your money.
I got Madison Rose, Char, Scott Ryan, Christoph Kubicki, Lucy Warman, Eric Taylor, Bailey Kalaji, Stephanie Zelza, Tyler Haas, Christopher Hubbard, Jill Citrone, Margarita Sanders.
Ooh.
I like Margarita Sanders.
I love it. It's my favorite.
She's just like, she's like, in an intervention right now for her alcoholism. Like, it was a cute name for a while. Like, she legally changed her name to Margarita.
Oh, I love the drink and I like the politics.
Catalina Windy Picnic.
I hope that's a real last name. We're from a long line of Windy Picnics. This is Ted Windy Picnic. I'm Robert Windy Picnic. Samantha Windy Picnic.
Deanna.
Honestly, that's a bummer. What's worse than a Windy Picnic? You got chips going everywhere.
Oh, that's true.
Deanna Gordon, Carl Tuell, Cole Geisman, Emma Murray, Stefan Steven Hendrickson, Diana Masoner, Victor Lopez, and Aaron Jacobson.
All right, I got one more list here. We got Patricia Jurgelette, Ursula...
Jurgelette?
No, Jurgelette. J-U-R-G-E-L-E-I-T, Jurgelette. Mm. Patricia. Mm. Ursula Sakowitz, Denise Balbay-Holt, Anna Badorf, Daniel Perez, David Moore, Connor, Peter, Jeffries, Simon Dowd, Ali Kaluzny, Morgan Goetz, John Rogan, Serena, Jason Aquaviva. Aquaviva, that's amazing.
Ooh.
Jason Aquaviva, Athens Tac-Tac, Amanda Thok, Daniel Ponzio, Matt Anthalsner, ladies and gentlemen, Pascal Labonte Cloutier. This is more of a statement. Miranda, I think you guys are all sexy. Ben Kissel, I'll wet your whistle. PSLMDR. I think we lost a little bit, but that's nice there. Ken Thompson and Sonia Christensen.
To round it up, I got Alicia Derrick, Kristen Crowley, Kyle Brannon, Jonathan Trumpour, Mandy Bowles, Heather Butler, Emma Cozy, Amy Braun, Amber Utley, Dee Erdine, Renee Rafat, Greg, Jamie Peterson, Allie Luttrell, Kathy Shriver, Chris Baum, BK Jenkins, Adam Storija, Chris Lewis, Dominique Conesiali.
Okay.
And Joe Kleinvolterink.
Thank you all so much. Ooh. You're the only reason this has been made possible, and we love you.
Give me more of your money.
Don't demand it. Trust me
with your money. I will be
no
so
one
good
trusts
to
you
it.
With their money. What's the best thing that you spent money on, Henry?
The sound hood. The sound hood that I'm currently in.
That works for the show.
If I can give everyone a little bit, if I could tell them what I spend my money on, I was able to get Invisalign this week.
He did. His teeth are fucking horrible. You're going to lose that pumpkin charm, but it's going to be great. You're going to be so much less pain.
I've been waiting. I got an email from my dentist that they were doing half off Invisalign this week, and I said, you know what? The Patreon money has allowed me to do this, so I'm going to get my teeth fixed.
That's amazing.
So you're going to hear me talk about that for the next year.
Can't wait to hear you talk about teeth.
I really, honestly, I'm looking forward to you being well and being happy and being fulfilled.
Thank you. Hey, as we say with all of you as well, hail yourselves.
Hail Satan.
Hail Gin.
Hail me. Magustalations, you're a piece of shit. You're a piece of shit. Give me your money. Give it to me.
Magustalations.